Tonight on Arena, Maria Doyle Kennedy on making music from home for her new album Fire on the Roof of Eden, and Apple's Cowboys and End of Sentence are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night, up for your consideration this evening from the virtual cinema, Apple's first feature from The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Christos Nikou, former assistant director to The Apprentice, Yargos. Not The Apprentice, to The Sorcerer, Yargos Lanthimos. Also, we have Cowboys, a story of love between father and child with Steve Zahn and a supporting cast including the wonderful Anne Dowd, i.e. Aunt Lydia, who we were talking about only last night on the programme. And finally, End of Sentence, a redemption story with some prominent Irish interests. Justin McGregor, Roe McDermott have seen all three. They join me now. We'll start with Apples, which put simply tells the story of Aris, a man who likes apples. I think there's probably a little bit more to it than that, Justin, is there?
Yes and no, I suppose. Yes, Aris, we meet Aris in his apartment, leaving the apartment, buying some flowers and getting on a bus. And when he is woken up at the end of the line, he doesn't know who he is. And it turns out there's an amnesia pandemic going around the world. He's the 14,562nd person in his city to be photographed because he has no ID on him. And they send these photos out to see if anybody recognizes them. And throughout, he is eating apples throughout this journey of trying to create a new identity, because the memory, it turns out, does not and will not come back in this pandemic. And then when he finds that apples are good for the memory, he switches to oranges. So it's a fascinating film. It just sort of slowly unfolds and just draws you in this really magical and wonderful way, and has some great twists at the end, for sure.
As Justin describes it there, Ro, I'm guessing that plot is not the major component for watching, not the major consideration when watching this film.
No, this is a new addition to this new Greek wave of kind of cine absurdism that, and as you mentioned, the director here was an assistant director to Yorgos Lanthimos, and this style of cinema, it's very, very about kind of a flat effect with characters, sparse dialogue. It's more about this atmosphere. But I think something that's interesting is that Christos Nikou, the director, he was also the second unit director on Richard Linklater's Before Midnight, which is a film all about dialogue and connection and warmth. And I think this explains why Apples has a more tender philosophy than Lanthimos's kind of darkly searing irony. But it is all about the atmosphere. And even stylistically, Nikou sets the tale in this kind of ahistoric analog version of Athens, where physical media provide this very crucial link with the past that becomes a plot point, but it is an eerily simplified recent past. It's this kind of nostalgically analog civilization before cell phones and social media, where a connection kind of has to be forged the old-fashioned way, and cameras are Polaroid cameras. So even the setting is slightly skewed in an interesting way.
Yeah, and when we're talking about Lanthimos, we're talking about Dogtooth from 2009, we're talking about The Lobster, that type of film that they in themselves were hard to pin down, and it sounds as if Nikou has a touch of that in there. But for sure, that mix of Linklater gives it an interesting twist, Justin. But what about the look of the film? Lanthimos, very specific kind of aesthetic. Is there something similar here?
Yeah, well, here it's very interesting. They go in, it's an old TV frame, it's 4x3, so it's not the widescreen, it's not your 16x9, and it's a very flat palette. Everything's kind of this dire, snottish green and this faded pale blues and browns. And everywhere he goes, this kind of color palette, except for the apple and the oranges that pop out, it's just sort of very, very flat. And he kind of sets the scene up, and it's very painterly where everybody is positioned in it. And there's very little editing. You know, they might come in for a close-up, but generally they let these scenes kind of play out. It's sort of reminiscent of Roy Andersson, the Swedish filmmaker, who likes to sort of set these shots and the scene doesn't start for about a minute after you start watching it. Now, this again has a bit more of that Linklater. It has a bit more accessibility, I think, to it without losing that wonderful absurdity, you know, that anyone who loves Samuel Beckett or Václav Havel's plays would recognize instantly.
We get into, I think, later on then, Ro, a kind of a critique of our own social media and indeed the technologies that we use. How does that fit in with the overall theme of apples and the odd bit of oranges in there too?
Yeah, because Aris goes to the hospital and he is being treated again, as Justin said. He's kind of the 14,000th person to go through this. So the doctor prescribes him a series of tasks, including riding a bike, going fishing, paying for a lap dance. And he gives him a Polaroid camera with which to chronicle them. And the resulting snapshots, they kind of feel like a commentary on selfie culture, documenting what happens, but there's no trace of enjoyment or enthusiasm. You know, Aris is getting a lap dance and very bluntly asks the woman to stop moving so he can take a picture where he's not smiling or enjoying himself in any way. But it's this idea of, will these things spark his memory? And it's such a fascinating, funny, writhing to witness. It's kind of like a Kafka character performing this silent comedy routine as he's awkwardly struggling. But it also becomes this almost existential Freshers Week, where he meets another woman who has also lost her memory. And together they go through these experiences, like trying to check off these boxes of experiences adults are meant to have and see what they provoke.
Yeah.
And some of them provoke nothing. But then Anna, as this woman describes watching the movie Titanic for the first time, and is explaining this as if it's a fictional film that made her cry. And so it's just really wry and funny.
Right. So Anna is played by Sofia Georgovasily, and Aris played by Aris Servitalis. It's essentially, though, Justin, you were saying, I think it's like a one-man show. It's a one-man film. The Anna character, does she not feature that much? Is it Aris's show, as it were?
I mean, very much so. I mean, she shows up. She shows up quite late. She's a few experiences ahead of him, like on the box. Box checking list, and he does help her out on a couple of her tasks, but then something goes a little bit wrong and we don't see her again for a while. They just have another scene together, and it's really about his, I think, perspective of trying to connect with her, and you think maybe for a moment it's going to go this kind of more conventional route, but of course it doesn't. It's not that kind of film, but just that the possibility, I think, of their relationship is just sort of beautifully handled. But eventually they just kind of miss, at least during, you know, in the course of the yeah. film. So no, it's very much about what would it be like for you, like a mindfulness exercise almost, to think about how you would rediscover yourself.
Just one final question on it, Ro. Given that we are dealing with an amnesia pandemic, and of course all the stories will, or the reviews, headlines would write themselves, or if it was this is very forgettable film, et cetera, but from what both of you are saying, it's not particularly forgettable. But does it speak in any way to our own pandemic at the moment?
I think there is something interesting, because I think something that has been fascinating to hear about during COVID is that people are rediscovering hobbies a lot of the time and doing things for pleasure instead of doing them for the kind of hustle culture, and you have to turn them into something productive or you have to turn them into a paycheck. And people are kind of embracing that free time now. And then also, we're not doing the normal things that people routinely document on social media. We're not going out to restaurants, so you can't take photos of that. We're not going on holidays. And I think there is something interesting to consider the sterility of our social media use, of living in a world where our personal identity has become a series of things to document, and to document them becomes the point rather than enjoying them. And I think what Apple speaks to is the difference between data and memory, and that difference is emotion, and tapping into emotion and being present, and that idea of really feeling who we are in our experiences rather than doing them for the sake of them. So I think that is hopefully a good message to bring as we start coming out of COVID, to stay in the moment and really connect instead of doing things because they look good.
And maybe a little message to those who are still tweeting pictures and sending up pictures of their porridge every morning, their porridge, you know, don't care whether you've got blueberries on it or seeds, it's fine, I'm okay, you had porridge.
But enjoy your porridge.
Don't be taking pictures of it, eat it before it goes cold. Stars from you on this one, first of all, Ro.
I'm going to give it a 4. I really liked it. I thought it was really interesting. I will say it remains quite opaque and vague, and I think some people might struggle with that. And I think it's hard to elevate a story above the level of parable when the basic concept is to keep the hero being very vague and from not knowing himself until the final moments. But I think it's a really interesting thought experiment, really enjoyable. It doesn't outstay its welcome. It's only 90 minutes, so 4 from me.
Always a good thing to be a 90 minutes in a film. And what are you saying overall, Justin?
Oh, no, I really connected with it. I think what Ro was saying about enjoying things, I really just enjoyed watching this movie. And I realized it was best not to have any expectation. And just going on that journey with Aris was absolutely wonderful. It made me want to eat an apple, so I gave it 5.
What a beautifully absurd reason to give it five, but that's the nature of the film. So five from Justin, four from Ro on our first film this evening, simply called Apples. Let's move on then to Cowboys, like the one-word titles that we have in the first two films at any rate. Long-standing indie darling here, Steve Zahn, stars as Troy, the father of a transgender boy who does his best to help his son, Joe, while his mother, Sally, played by Gillian Bell, struggles to come to terms with her child's gender identity. Set in the wilds of Montana, Cowboys is written and directed by Anna Kerrigan. This is a very timely story and one that needs to be handled with great sensitivity, Ro.
Yeah, and I think it is handled so well. I think there's a really beautiful gentleness and warmth and complexity to the story. So it's set in Montana and it stars Steve Zahn, who's kind of been a mainstay of Hollywood indie character acting for 30 years. And he brings his A-game really playing Troy, who is this roguish, big-hearted guy who also has a drinking problem and bipolar disorder and a prison record. And Troy was once married to Sally, played by Gillian Bell. And he is able to see his child, even though there is no court order enforcing it, and Sally allows this. And his child absolutely adores Troy and hates the girly dresses and dolls that Sally keeps supplying, and instead loves the Stetsons and denims and huge belt buckles that Troy has. And Troy kind of laughs along with this and his child's tomboy mannerisms, which triggers an outburst from their child Joe, who says, "Tomboys are just another type of girl, and I'm not a girl," because their child is not their daughter, but their transgender son, whose name is Joe, not Josie, as they have been calling Joe for so long. And Troy, even though he isn't hugely educated, he understands this on an intuitive level. He understands his child is unhappy. He understands his child knows who they are. But Sally can't grasp this. And it's a really outstanding performance from child actor Sasha Knight in this role as this trans kid. And then everything goes a bit wrong when Troy decides that the best thing to do to give Joe some freedom is to essentially kidnap Joe for a camping trip and take him and a stolen horse. And he, in Troy's mind, this will be their escape from North to Canada, just two cowboys together.
So that's the kind of the present moment of the film, is that road movie essentially, or that horsey movie as they make their way or they try to make their way towards Canada. But then we get the sort of how the story has unfolded and how the family have been presented with Joe's dilemma in a series of flashbacks. And this clip that I'm about to play is one of those flashbacks, in fact. Gillian Bell, Steve Zahn, mother and father here, Sally and Troy, argue over Joe's gender identity. And be warned, there's some language in the midst of this clip as well.
Did you hear what I just said about Joe?
Yeah, Joe likes cowboy hats. So what? She just wants to be like you. And you encourage it, Troy?
No. She said that she is a boy.
Oh, God.
That she feels like she's in the wrong body, like she's... like an alien living in someone else's body, like that Body Snatchers movie.
Like the Body Snatchers movie, Troy?
What are you talking about? Look, I don't know if I understand it, or if it's just you kids.
Fill her head with all these fucking stories about what it's like to be a man.
But she's...
to be a cowboy. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that sounds like fun to her. Going out on joyrides in the middle of the night. Going to the bar with your buddies. Going fishing. Going hunting. I mean... she thinks you're a goddamn hero. Well, look who gets to suck. Look who gets to be the lame-ass mom, stuck at home, doing the dishes, cleaning the fucking toilet. I mean, no wonder she wants to be a goddamn boy. She thinks I'm a piece of shit.
This is not about you. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Who would choose to be a girl?
Gillian Bell as Sally there, the mother, and Steve Zahn as Troy, the father there of Joe, the transgender boy whose story has been told in this film, Cowboys. And we hear that Joe is watching that from outside, or at least able to hear the row that's going on. I suppose an important aspect here, Justin, is the way that the confusion, particularly in Sally's case, the confusion over trying to understand what her child is going through is not judged in any way.
Yeah, no, it's, so often in Hollywood films, you know, it's black and white and somebody's clearly in the right and someone's clearly in the wrong. And here they've really gone, I mean, Rose said it perfectly, really gently, as somebody who's confused and really does not quite getting it, and somebody who gets it but doesn't understand it. And these sort of two perspectives are allowed to really develop and work themselves out in the film. There's no rush to judge them. There's a coming to terms that they're going through that is played out on screen. That's just done really, really well. And then heartbreaking when there's a scene in the toy store at the end with Sally, and what she does to express her growing understanding of her son is beautiful.
Yeah, in fact, I think I might have that clip, but before I go to it, let's talk about Sacha Knight playing the character of Joe here. Mm. A breakout star for you, Ro, you were saying, and obviously this performance is vital to telling the story.
Yeah, really, really remarkable performance. And Sacha Knight, he's a really wonderful young actor. He is himself trans and gender non-binary. And I think that is so important, because I think, I will say, some of the dialogue around Joe's gender feels a little bit on the nose, and like it's just allowing audiences who might not be familiar with trans children in particular and the rhetoric around them, it's giving them an introduction to that. And for people who are slightly more versed in it, it might feel a bit on the nose. But the most resonant interlude in the film are those without dialogue, and really come from Sacha Knight's performance, because there are moments with Joe when Sally has forced him to wear kind of mortifyingly girly girl uniforms of pink flouncy tops and cascading blonde dresses, and you see how uncomfortable he is, but you also see how he's studying the body language and the masculine camaraderie and even the style of his father and his father's buddies at a bowling alley, and you see him smiling when he's looking at and then trying on later an all denim cowboy outfit, and looking at, you know, the belt buckle and that feeling of just feeling in his body and feeling like he is finally expressing himself as he is. And I think that sense of emotional complexity that comes through without words could really only be achieved by somebody who has gone through this experience themselves. And it's just such a gorgeous performance, but it also shows that this film really works the best when it lets its actors do their thing, because the dialogue can be on the nose, but I think it's those moments that are really going to strike chords with particularly every queer kid who ever felt like an outsider, and then all the parents who've gone through the struggle of trying to understand their child and really trying to do the best for them, which both parents in the film are trying to do, and they are flawed, but they are trying to do their best.
And unfortunately, looks don't work on radio. We can't manage that, so the clips have to feature dialogue, which is what I have for this second clip, featuring Sacha Knight playing the character of Joe in the store with his mother, Sally, played by Gillian Bell. They're arguing when Joe wants to buy some cowboy-themed toys and a book.
What are you doing?
Can I get this?
You don't need those.
I like this one. Yeah, it's only $1. I'll pay you when I get home. I have money saved up.
Let's pick one toy. Or we'll pick none. That's what I thought. Let's pick one toy. How about this? Look, that's fun. I'm trying to help you out here. Come on. She's cool. Look at her.
I don't want that.
Okay, well then we're not getting any toys today. Joe? Joe?
What about this?
No, we're not getting that book. Put it back.
Why? That will get it for me.
When other little girls come over to play, they are not going to want to play with these toys or read those books. You want friends, don't you?
Not dumb ones.
Okay.
Mommy, no.
No. Put it back. Joe, I am not going to fight with you here. Put the book back.
And that's Sacha Knight and Gillian Bell in a scene there from Cowboys. Justin, I think that actually the scene you were talking about is later on. That's a bit earlier in the film. But we're in Montana here. The look of this film, it made me want to be in a horse riding in the open plains, or not the open plains, in the landscape of Montana.
Oh, yeah, no, it definitely gives the full John Ford treatment to Montana, the big sky, some beautiful vistas, and then contrasting that with these really sort of wonderful, quiet and intimate moments in the tent, you know, with Joe and his dad. But yeah, Montana looks spectacular. It was funded by a grant from the state of Montana, and I see what they gave the grant. It's just a wonderful backdrop of this kind of wild, wide open space, but contrasted with this kind of claustrophobic feeling that Joe is having of trying to, you know, to emerge as his true self. A great contrast.
One final thing on this row, I suppose the title Cowboys, this is as much about, the machoism that is expected of young boys if they want to be cowboys, and of cowboys themselves, and how young girls are excluded from that type of, you know, fantasy game of being a cowboy.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so interesting about the film, and particularly in America, where of course the cowboy is this kind of infamous archetype, and it explores how this cowboy tough guy archetype impresses itself on a gender norm conforming child. It asks who says that cowboys have to be boys, and how do other limiting ideas about gender affect children and trans children when the myths are about their gender. But also it explores things like the further issue of how cowboys and that image idolizes and fetishizes guns and even the phallic nature of guns, and that comes into the plot later on. But I think again, even the clip we played earlier of Sally asking, like, who would choose to be a girl in this lifestyle and this culture where these are the ideas of what women should do, what men should do, is complicated and really, really interesting. I will say, I love the ideas in this film. There is sometimes an uneven balance between going too simplistic with these ideas and occasionally veering into melodrama. So I love the ideas they're playing with. I think the execution can sometimes be a bit flawed.
All right. Stars from you, Ro.
I'm going to give it 3.5. I absolutely adored all of the ideas in the film, but just as I said, I think sometimes it feels slightly underbaked and a little bit reductive, but I adore the performances and there's so much to appreciate.
And Justin?
Yeah, I thought there are a few plot holes and some moments, but just overall, I think a really, really well-handled, you know, film, gentle film about a difficult issue and a great night in.
Okay, great night in is what you're saying for that particular one. Let's move on then to our final film, End of Sentence. Another father and son story here, and another directorial debut, it has to be said as well. A father and son, this time on a journey across to Ireland, in fact, to scatter the ashes of their dead mother and wife, respectively. Andrea Irvine, Sarah Bulger feature in the supporting cast. But really, the film is about the central performances of Logan Lerman as Sean Fogle, that's the son, and the always interesting John Hawkes as his father, Frank. Again, it could be cliched, this, in, the guy's getting out of prison at the very start, his mother visits him before he's getting out, and she's dying. It has all the facility to go terribly wrong very quickly, Justin.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating because, you've got this alpha male son who's in prison and is just getting out, and you've got the very gentlemanly old school, and you know, John Hawkes is quite physically small as well. And it seems like it could really easily go on this cliched path, and then it does something wonderful and completely avoids going on that cliched path by really letting them slowly get to know each other and let us slowly see them on this journey that unfolds, obviously, as it does in a road movie, internally and externally through Ireland.
Yeah, and last week we were talking about Wild Mountain Thyme on the programme, Ro, and about the Irish cliches that are sometimes presented to us from Hollywood. Does this avoid those Irish cliches? But they're coming to a very contemporary Ireland. They're coming over to the place that the mother used to visit regularly and knows so well. What kind of Ireland is presented to us?
Yeah, I will say, I think something that was really striking to me is the plot bears an uncanny resemblance to 2019's The Last Rite, which had Niamh Alger and Michael Huseman, where an American and his estranged son must transport a dead person across Ireland, picking up a troubled young woman along the way, which is very unnerving. I don't know if this is a new requirement for American tourists entering Ireland, like a negative COVID test on someone's ashes, but I think End of Sentence, it does fall into some of the same traps about a magical Ireland that The Last Rite deployed, where country people speak wisdom, all women are either Sarah Bulger, i.e. a romantic interest, or a 60-year-old Irish mammy fussing about it at a funeral. There are aerial shots of damp cliffs that are supposed to soothe all ills. And there is, of course, a scene with a sing-along of a very traditional song in an Irish pub.
Which seemed like a scene from a different film from the rest of the film in many ways.
I do, and I think that might be just appealing to kind of American and international audiences of this is the Ireland you know. But I think what makes it so powerful is that when the director trusts the emotional heart of the material in the second half particularly, and when he trusts his actors, the film really soars above kind of this possibly cliched plot and these tonal missteps. Because it's so layered and so nuanced in so many ways, both thematically and performance-wise, that it really overcomes any potential obstacles.
All right. Let's listen to a clip that features the aforementioned Sarah Bolger playing the character of Jewel, the son very interested in her, the son being Sean Fogle, played by Logan Lerman, and Frank Fogle, the father, played by John Hawkes. They're all in the car together, travelling around Ireland, when this discussion happens.
So what is this, anyway? Little father and son fishing trip.
We kind of skipped over all the things that started with father son.
Bail.
Sorry, can you repeat that? I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I said unless you count posting bail.
Posting bail, all right. I was like 15. My friends and I. He took his car out for a spin, he called the cops, reported it stolen. The cops got us in 2 minutes. Threw us in jail. Everyone's dads came within the hour. This guy, 24 hours.
His mother was in the hospital again. I was dealing with that, trying to deal with him.
That's right. I'm the cause of my father's nervous breakdown.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't say
it. It wasn't a nervous breakdown. I was doing the best I could during a very difficult time, but my son couldn't grasp that. He wanted Clark Kent for a father.
Had Clark Kent, wanted Superman.
Well, and we just wanted a good son.
Father, Frank Fogle, played by John Hawkes. Son, Sean Fogle, played by Logan Lerman. And Sarah Bolger, the character of Jewel, who's travelling with them in the car as they go off to bury the, to throw the ashes, spread the ashes of their dead wife and mother, respectively, across a lake in Northern Ireland. Justin, these type of cliches that we were speaking about earlier on, a lot of the avoidance here is down to the two central performances, particularly Sean Fogle and Frank Fogle.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, as Ro was saying, it's sort of fascinating. If you describe the plot to someone, it would sound so cliche, and then it goes this other direction, almost inside the movie, that this more subtle film is happening. I mean, John Hawkes has done something like 136 films, and he's not ever the lead, and he's absolutely wonderful as Frank. He has a real vulnerability, especially as he gets to know his wife before they met and before they married, and it's kind of drawn to knowing more, and it's conflicted about how he feels about it. And the son, you know, played by Logan Lerman, who, I mean, the Percy Jackson movies are what they are, actually shows great depth and a great, you know, vulnerability underneath this kind of alpha maledom that again sort of slowly lets him connect with his father, but it's so unrushed. There's a weird 15 minutes where, you know, there's a stolen car and dogs chasing them, and it goes really Hollywood. But it for pulls those back scenes from that. Where they're together, it's fantastic when it goes back. Yeah.
And the other important performance, I suppose, in terms of the overall plot, is that of Sarah Bolger as Jewel. How did she work for you, Ro?
I think Sarah Bolger, I think it's a slightly thankless role in that it's presented as a kind of manic pixie dream girl plot device that we've seen before. But I think Bolger, she has an incredibly intelligent way of performing, and she layers her performances with things, and she brings a complexity and undoes some of, again, the tropes that could be put on that character, which is really impressive. And I think, as Justin was saying, it is the moment-to-moment choices of the actors in this film that really heightened it. They're subtle and layered and powerful, and there's such an empathy here that shows all of the characters' worst mistakes and worst choices are a result of conditioning and trauma that they just don't have the tools to understand.
And Justin, we're dealing with a debut director here in Elfar Adelsteins. How does he fare and stars from you?
Yeah, I think when he is inside a scene and directing his actors, he is, it's an amazing debut on that level. And yeah, like the final scene between Sarah Bolger and Logan Lerman is there's so much going on. It's so fantastic. So an easy 4 stars. Just that 15 minutes kind of got to me, but
so
other than that.
An easy 4 from Justin and Ro.
I'm going to give it 4 as well. I had the exact opposite response to this film than Cowboys, in that I wasn't entirely on board with the premise, but the execution is really, really surprising and beautiful. And I found the ending really, really emotional.
All right. Yeah, it is a very, very touching ending for sure. Roe McDermott and Justin McGregor there speaking to us about our three films tonight: Apples, Cowboys and End of Sentence. Maria Doyle Kennedy and her musical partner and husband, Kieran Kennedy, have been keeping busy over the last year with a series of live music sessions from their own home. They released new music every month. Those tracks have formed the latest album, which is called Fire on the Roof of Eden. It's the 11th release on Maria's Mermaid label. This is how the album opens.
Gotta be sitting straight up, caught upstream, walk to the end of a dream. And back again.
Little taster there of the opening track, Cyan, from Maria Doyle Kennedy's new album, Fire on the Roof of Eden. Delighted that Maria is joining us on the programme this evening. I wanted to play the beginning of that, Maria, as the album opened, because I thought, the two of them? Just the two of them? At home? How did they get that sound that makes it feel as if you're in a huge studio with several musicians all around you?
Well, I think that's a testament to the genius of Kieran Kennedy. I mean, we're lucky, I suppose, in that it's possible to record at home now. Mm. You know, all of the stuff that you need has become more accessible and available and smaller. But also, I mean, Kieran is a producer as well as a musician, and he has been making albums for me and for other people for quite a long time. So he just got really, really good at it. Yeah. I mean, it is done in our kitchen at the end of the table. The studio is set up on another little small table just at the end of our room, and we did do it all there. Yeah. But he's kind of a genius, and he can make it sound amazing.
Yeah, now the sound right across the album is really extraordinary. But that really, when I put it on, listening to it, I went, wow. And even more so when I get into studio here and I got it on the big speaker, you get a better whack of it in some ways. I said, Maria, that this had grown out of the live shows that you had been doing. And you refer to the album as kind of being a document of your year. How was the year?
It was pretty challenging, to be honest, I think, like for most people, you know, and I kind of ricocheted around the place in terms of how I was feeling. Some days I would be fine and I would be very grateful to have somewhere warm and safe to live and be surrounded by, you know, luckily I love my family and I'm very close to them, and it was wonderful to be able to be together and just have a chance to look at them. And some days I would be terrible. I would have had terrible fear of wondering, you know, what was my purpose beyond my family ever going to be again? Were we ever going to be able to gig or play live? And looking around at all the rest of my friends, particularly the live performers, the musicians and actors who suddenly had kind of lost the thing that they did that made sense of the world for them. And then other days you would just be kind of, you'd write or record a good song and you'd be delighted with yourself and you'd jump around the kitchen for joy. And then other days you'd be angry and frustrated. And why could you not travel more than 2 kilometers or something? It was really, it was hard to process it all and keep an eye on yourself and your own mind, and also keep an eye on the kids. And they were all doing their homeschooling. And like everybody, you know, we were all going through it, but it was challenging. I making the album was something really incredible to hold on to during the time, a purpose and a way to kind of just channel all those feelings into something artistic and something that made sense of the world to me.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, music in particular, and hearing music and having that facility to go into the world that music can, the imaginative world that music can present to you, I think it was a huge balm to many people during very difficult times.
I think it
times.
Was a real testament to what music can do, that, you know, we it can offer comfort, or it can also vent, you can rage through it, you know, you can dance with it. It really can do a lot of things for us.
Well, I mean, you're so used, Maria, to travelling between both your music and your acting career. To be in one place for an extended period of time must be an unusual feeling for you. But did you do some filming of Outlander during the period as well, or has that just come back recently?
Only just come back now. No, we didn't go anywhere for a year, over a year. And yeah, it was strange. And we were supposed to do quite a lot of touring. We were supposed to go to America to play and to Europe. And we had quite a few festivals booked at home as well last year. And they all went. And it was strange to be in the one place. It's not how we would normally live. We're fairly nomadic, Kieran and I. And I mean, it's been, many, many years since we haven't done a gig or gone away to do one. I did start to feel a bit kind of, trapped in my own small space. But, you know, I walked a lot. I think a lot of people did that.
Yeah,
but
a lot of that.
I walked a lot, and just getting out and moving was a good way to not feel that way. And now we can move a little bit again, and that's really great. I missed even the small journeys, never mind the gigs.
Yeah.
Like, I really missed being able to go and see my mom. She lives in the middle of the country. She's in Boyle, County Roscommon. Hi, mom. I'd say she's listening. And just, you know, all of those connections.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're good at that, aren't we, Irish people? We like to gather. We like to share experiences communally and live. And so I missed all of the ways of we do that. I missed the hugs. I'm a hugger.
The hugs would be welcome when the time comes that we can all do that again.
The
for
hugs
sure.
will be mighty. We'll be breaking people with the hugs.
What did it? Do you think, Maria, that it changed how you approached the making of the music or the writing of the songs, or the what effect did it have actually on that process?
Well, there's a couple of things, I think. I mean, the album, there's quite a lot of quite different songs on it. There's some very gentle ones, and there are some very ragey ones. There's some kind of sad ones, and there's some very tender ones. There's some quite a lot of just instrumental music as well. And because we were going through all those feelings and trying to process them and understand them. And one thing about the time made me just really, really finally go, I don't need anybody's permission to make this. It doesn't have to fit anybody's perception. It is just what we want to make and how we want to make it. So I didn't worry about any of that. Sometimes, you know, people are trying to box it all into one certain type. I didn't worry about it. I just let the music come out and felt that it was all part of this thing we were making, and it was meant to be together. And even though there are sort of different kinds of songs and music, I think the fact that we did make it all very much in the one place at the end of the kitchen table, that sound does bind it all together.
Oh, so the sound does.
I think that was the...
The sound does bind it together. You're for certain you're right about that. But it really did strike me, the diversity of styles across it. And it's a 75-minute album, 24 tracks, I think, is the final count. But there was one track quite early on again, which I thought in some ways is kind of like a little microcosm of the album, in that in the space of a minute here, we get several different styles and feels.
I am a purple girl to my mother, like her now a mothering daughter, and I wrap my children warm and tight. I worry about them when they sleep at night. I am a purple girl to my father, like him now I feel the cold, and I wrap my children warm and tight. I worry about them when they sleep at night.
That's amazing. That's the first minute of Purple Girl, which is a minute and 45. And there are several short little tracks like that. And as you say, Maria Doyle Kennedy, some of them shorter tracks on the current album, Fire on the Roof of Eden. But it really struck me there, you know, how, as I say, and maybe it's part of that thing of not caring to a certain extent. I don't care what people think of this. I want to do this now, and I want to have a little bit of bluegrass banjo feel in there. And I want to almost have that. It's not quite rap hip hop, but there's almost a kind of a speaking quality as it moves further along.
Yeah, it just came out that way, and it sounded beautiful. So we were happy to leave it like that. That song was inspired by a Lorca poem, Green, and it was written. I started to write it. Quite a long time ago when my youngest son was born, and I suddenly started thinking about how much my parents had thought about me when I was a baby. And that way you kind of swap over your feelings to really appreciate your parents when you have children yourself.
Yeah.
It's been in the gestation for quite a while.
Oh, well, there you go. I want to finish up, Maria, by playing the single, which is a track called Lucinda. And this brings us back to a time when we used to go to gigs in actual theatres with people on a stage and an audience down.
Yeah. Just
tell us the story behind this as we head into it.
Well, it was written, I went to see Lucinda Williams in the Olympia with my friend Mai, and both Mai and I had done deals at home with our own husbands who were supposed to be going out themselves. And we were like, no, we'll be home early. We'll be home by 11. You guys can, you can go to your party then or whatever. But Lucinda absolutely rocked. She was incredible. And we got the chance to go and have a drink with her afterwards. And so we did, and then we had several more, and we did not come home at 11. So I came home very, very late, and in order to sort of not get into trouble, I decided I would try and write a song and get myself out of it. So that's where the song Lucinda came from.
Okay, so he didn't get his night out, but he got a song instead. That was the compromise. Lovely to speak to you this evening, Maria, and looking forward to seeing you in person back in studio at some point soon. Look after yourself and congrats on the album.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sean.
Maria Doyle Kennedy there. Let's listen to that single then. That was the barter for not getting home in time. Lucinda.
So brightly.
I'm quite sure she was forgiven when she presented that song. That's Maria Doyle Kennedy with the song Lucinda, a new single from the album Fire on the Roof of Eden, which is out now. You can find out full information on mariadk.com. This Sunday evening at 10 p.m, GJN radio presenter Dan Hegarty will air a documentary on 2FM looking back on an album widely regarded by many as one of the greatest Irish albums ever produced, Whipping Boy's 1995 album Heartworm. The documentary, which is entitled When We Were Young, features interviews with the band members as well as people who were around the band at the time, looking at the writing and recording of the album and the impact it had on the band, and that the band made at the time. Indeed, their enduring appeal. The title, When We Were Young, comes from one of the singles from Heartworm, and Dan Hegarty is joining me this evening to tell me a little bit more. Before we hear the When We Were Young, the song itself, and a little bit of the documentary, maybe bring us back to the band themselves, Dan, and the 1980s Dublin that formed them.
Well, I suppose back then, Sean, Dublin was kind of known as a city of 1,000 rock bands. Now, I don't know if anyone actually did a count whether there was 1,000 rock bands in Dublin at the time, but it certainly did seem like there was. There was kind of the established bands that were kind of around at the time, like Something Happens and Emotional Fish, The Fat Lady Sings, Our House, and those. And then there was kind of a slightly younger generation of bands that Whipping Boy were a part of, with them and Roller Skate Skinny and others. So there's a lot going on. It was a busy city musically.
And they had some success with an album called Submarine, which had been released on an independent label. Had that kind of laid out a stall that suggested they were a cut above the rest or a cut above many?
Yeah, well, that album came out following a number of EPs and singles. It came out in 1992 on a Dublin-based label called Liquid Records that had put out some other music by great Irish bands at the time, like the Blue Angels and Toasted Heretic. What it had done, I think, it was quite a raw sounding record, even when you listen to it all these years later. What it had done, it had shown us that this was a local band with potential to do much, much bigger things. And it was your classic debut album. It fulfilled the potential that a lot of people had hoped it would.
And that potential came to full fruition with the 1995 album then, Heartworm.
Very much so. Heartworm was a very different thing. It was a much bigger sounding album, both in overall sound, and I think the songs were more fully formed as well. And I know some people at the time grumbled that it was too well produced, but really, when you listen back to it now, you realise it was beautifully produced because, you know, a quarter of a century later, the production values, the overall sound of it still stands up. And that's quite a feat.
For sure. Let's have a listen then to the song that has given you the title for the documentary from the album Heartworm, the song When We Were Young. That's the song When We Were Young from the album that we're speaking about this evening, Heartworm, all connected with the documentary When We Were Young. DJ and radio presenter Dan Hegarty will be presenting that documentary on 2FM this coming Sunday evening. There's a real nostalgia feel to that, even as the lyrics start out at the beginning there, talking about when we were young, nobody died, nobody got older. And then that kind of at the end of that kind of wistful feeling that comes across, Dan.
Yeah, there is. And I remember even at the time thinking that, and I probably think about it a little bit more now that I listen to it. And I suppose there's some lyrical references that someone much younger is going, what's a rubber Johnny? And you're going, go and ask your grandparents. We'll just leave that one, please.
Yeah, yeah. If you're your grandparents, you don't even want to be asking your parents that one. What about what the band did or didn't achieve despite all the hopes that were there for them?
Well, look, I suppose you can look at the things two ways. No, the album wasn't a massive commercial success. It didn't bring them riches and fame and things like that. But I think there's plenty of music from that time that did do very, very well. Mm. But they're not being spoken about in a public forum like this is, like we are here today. So, I mean, I suppose you've got to balance that, you know, all these years later. Well, what means more to you? That you had some fame, you had some success, or that you didn't get to where you wanted to go, but people still have such a fondness of this album all these years later. And might I add that a lot of people have picked up on it along the way, and there are many of those.
Right. Well, you spoke to several people around in and around the band at the time, including guitarist Paul Page. Let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary featuring Paul Page.
We'd been around for, you know, the guts of 6 years. We released a couple of EPs on an English independent label, and then we signed with Liquid for that one album. For a while, it did get a little bit crazy. We had EMI and Sony really trying their damnedest to get us to sign, and they'd got to hear some demo tapes that we hadn't even sent to them. We'd just done these demo tapes, and the engineer passed the demo tape to a Sony A&R man, and from there the thing kind of snowballed. So we hadn't actually been actively looking for a record deal with a major label. We'd just been recording some songs, and all of a sudden we had this thing where both Sony / Columbia and EMI were chasing the band. So it was kind of bizarre. It was nice in a way, because it felt like, you know, there was an opportunity for us to continue making music, because that was in doubt. When we went into that little rehearsal studio, we did question whether the band had any kind of a future.
Paul Page, guitarist there with When We Were Young, the documentary that we're speaking about, and that's it's Dan Hegarty that's with us this evening talking about the documentary on Sunday evening on 2FM. Listening to him there, what other sort of stories did you get from other band members and those you spoke to?
Well, I mean, I spoke to Dave Fanning and Tanya Sweeney of the Irish Times. Mm. And I spoke to the gentleman that signed them as well. He's called Ola McGowan. I think you might know him. And he had some very interesting insight into it too. One of the really interesting parts of it is people that picked up on them along the way, and I've kind of mentioned this, Jenny Houston, formerly of 2FM, now of Edge Only Jewelry, moved to Ireland just after it came out, and she discovered it through No Disco. Also, people like Torsten Kinsella from God Is an Astronaut, who's been very influenced by that album over the years too. So you heard a lot of reference points. I don't want to give too much away, Sean.
You want people to tune in on 10 p.m. on Sunday evening. We listen, Dan, I'll give people the details. When Were You Young? Telling the story of the classic Whipping Boy album, Heartworm, broadcast this Sunday evening, 10 p.m. on 2FM. Great, great album, says Tom in a text. Let's see. First vinyl record I ever bought in 1989. Still play it, doesn't skip, says Michael Daly. And love this album. I'm sure it's been said before, but it must have influenced Fontaine's Dublin. Yes, that was mentioned in this studio, Tom Swift, to me before we came, before I came down to this studio this evening. But that is our lot for this Thursday night. Liam Murphy was the researcher. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound supervision this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by the man who signed Whipping Boys, the bold Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.